All right, everybody, it's Monday, and that means it's time for us to get our regular dose of cannabis science with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Mitch, how you doing?
Having a great day.
Oh, it is a great day. It's July 10th, the unofficial dab day in America, the so-called oil holiday. And so I thought we'd open up our discussion by talking about concentrates, extracts, dabs, as they are known. And they've become a lot of concern because some of our opponents are saying, wow, these new dabs are so super potent. They're so hyper strong. We've got no experience with people using these. Who knows what's going to happen in 10, 20, 30 years? Is this something we need to worry about? Is there any data on this, Dr. Mitch?
The sad truth is, my student Mallory Laughlin and I published the very first DABS article back in 2014, basically saying, hey, we don't know a lot, but here's what people say. And what everybody said was, I use DABS and nothing bad has happened to me, but I'm really worried that something bad's going to happen to someone else. So they literally said things like, I think it creates withdrawal. I think it creates tolerance faster, but for everybody else, not me. Well, clearly it's got to happen to somebody if it's really going to happen. That paper has been cited 60 times since 2014. I mean, that's astounding for a marijuana-related paper. If I've got anything that's cited 100 times, the chair of my department, you know, does a flip. So it's stunning, but then when you look at every single one of them, they're all just saying, we need more data, we need more research, we need more data. And it's sad but true that what has happened is everybody knows we need to do the research. There is the occasional toxicology thing laying out some alarmist stuff, but we all now seem to have sources of DABs that we can trust. If there really is more rapid withdrawal or tolerance, guess we would, you know by now. But unfortunately, when you call the National Institute on Drug Abuse or places like that and say, hey, I'd really like to study this, they just don't get worked up about it, and they're not willing to give you the money that would be required to do this right. So we end up doing the best we can on the shoestring and not really being capable of answering the question as clearly as we'd like.
All right. Well, how about, you know, aside from the, you know, just the concentrated THC itself, what about other aspects of concentrates, like perhaps pesticides or funguses that might be in the source material then being concentrated in the extract?
So there was one article in Journal of Toxicology Research in 2015 suggesting that that really could be a legitimate concern, but they couldn't actually find any of it in the DABs that they had confiscated. So again, I feel like people seem to be fairly well aware of these potential issues, but somehow or other they're doing okay with avoiding them. When BHO was the big deal and everybody was so concerned and it was all going to be so dreadful and carcinogenic, but it seems like DABS makers have figured out a way to get the butane out of the product in the end, and they're willing to, you know, get into the relevant work in order to make that happen. So I do feel like, you know, down the line, we'd love to have better controls on all cannabis-related products, but the majority of folks in the industry seem to really want to have repeat customers and create a product that's safe and usable.
Well, the bottom line in all of this would be a legal concentrate is certainly going to be safer than an illegal one.
I gotta say, the opportunities for legalization on this seem like they would have a lot more benefit than even with flower cannabis.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's take a look at some of the studies that have come across the wires in the past couple of weeks. Most recent one saying youth cannabis use and cannabis use disorders declined over the past decade, even as we were sending out the wrong message. Dr. Mitch, how did that happen?
Well, I can't, you know, jump up and down because this isn't the hugest decrease ever. It went from 15.8 to 13.1%. So, you know, we're talking 2 percentage points or so. But the fact is, the sky didn't fall the way everyone swore that it was going to. And I do feel like I need to look at more than just the abstract here. I couldn't get the original article because the definition for cannabis use disorders has changed in that time. And I'm worried that people will make too big a deal out of this. And it's really just because we dropped that ridiculous legal problems symptom. And that thing was just, you know, incredibly racist and biased and stupid. And if that's really the only reason that this has changed, then we're able to say, hey, this is really just stable. But more importantly, I feel like the potential for bias is gone. And the idea that, you know, suddenly everybody was going to be a cannabis addict after legalization is clearly not true.
How about this next study? Federally funded researchers believe they've made strides toward developing a marijuana breathalyzer. You know, they keep saying they want this marijuana breathalyzer. It seems like when there's a will, there's a way. Are we going to actually see this developed?
I'm afraid we are, and it's about the stupidest waste of money I can imagine. As everybody who's ever used cannabis in a group of more than two people can attest, cannabis tolerance varies dramatically across people, and the idea that we're going to have some special level of nanograms that's going to co-vary with driving ability is completely fallacious. I would much rather see this money spent on a roadside sobriety test where anybody who is under any circumstances, whether you've had too many Benadryl or you're just too tired or something like that, has to, you know, walk the straight line, ride the unicycle, whatever it takes to make sure that they're really sober enough to drive. And let's stick with something that really correlates with driving ability, not some imaginary measure of something inside your body.
It seems the difference in this article compared to other marijuana breathalyzers ones that we've covered had to do with the way they were trying to detect it, having to do with the THC vapor pressure in our breath. I mean, how obscure is this?
To tell the truth, there was a move to do the first alcohol breathalyzers in a comparable way. A researcher back in Indiana, back in my graduate program, years before I'd even gotten there, had tried that. But the hope is that somehow this vapor pressure is going to reveal more recent cannabis use, because we do know that obviously blood and urine screens are going to lag actual objective intoxication rates. So I'm glad they're sort of heading in that direction. But again, I'm just never going to be a fan of the breathalyzer approach to intoxication.
Okay. The next study we have to deal with has to do with bipolar disorder and mood disorders. Says that cannabis use disorder could be a factor in the evolution and prognosis of bipolar disorder. We're always a little, you know, careful when we discuss these relationships between mental health disorders and cannabis use. Does this one fill in any blanks we didn't already know?
No, unfortunately, this kind of muddies the water yet again. I think partly the awareness about cannabis and its impact on sleep has to become our new public service announcements. Some strains really help sleep, some do not. Disturbed sleep is often one of the best predictors of a subsequent manic episode. And I think what's happening is people who've already got some subclinical hypomanic symptoms think, oh, I'm going to get some nice sleep tonight with this indica, inadvertently, because they don't have a good source, end up with a sativa that keeps them awake at night, and then their sleep's out of whack, they go to work, and next thing they know, they're, you know, super hypomanic and can't believe how messed up everything is. So I feel like this is a preventable issue, not necessarily causal in the biochemical sense for bipolar disorder, but could be a contributor simply because cannabis can mess with sleep.
I see. And this goes, you know, dovetails into the next study about cannabis use being prevalent among patients with psychotic symptoms in the ER and THC being correlated with psychotic episodes. Again, we can't tease out, is this chicken and egg kind of a thing? Are people self-medicating or is this a causal thing?
Between these data and some previous publications from the 90s, mostly Thorncrafts, it does look like if you are already diagnosed with schizophrenia, you really should stay away from the plant. In part, it seems like it predicts a higher likelihood of a subsequent psychotic episode, or at least a shorter duration between the first one and the second one. I totally buy that. We all know that THC has some, shall we say, magical ideation-inducing abilities. Unfortunately, if you've got a high risk for schizophrenia, this plant just isn't for you. If you've got a psychotic identical twin, don't use cannabis either. The thing that kind of upsets me, though, is there are lots of both soft and hard drugs that could contribute to this. I noticed that if you look really closely at the tobacco literature, folks with psychotic disorders also use a lot of tobacco, but I think it's mostly because they're bored and want a stimulant. So I don't want to pretend like this is causal. so much as something that seems to happen as part of a self-medication problematic use and then turns out to be more trouble than it's worth. And essentially, it's fair for us to say, if you're psychotic, don't use cannabis.
There we go. How would someone know, though? I mean, you say if someone has a diagnosis of schizophrenia, don't get involved with the plant. If they've got an identical twin or a family history of these sorts of mental issues, to not get involved with it. But what if, you know, they've got none of that and they're just going out and their first experiences with marijuana? What would let them know that, wait a minute, this is probably not going the right way? Like, how does someone who's a newbie tell the difference between a regular high and something that might be leading the wrong direction?
Odds are high if it's aversive to you, if you find yourself painfully self-conscious after a low dose of cannabis, mildly paranoid, constantly asking your friends, do you still like me? Do you still like me? You know, that kind of stuff, that this really isn't a plan for you. And it doesn't have to turn into a full-blown psychotic break. And trust me, everyone is happy to respect that. So it's not like there's some kind of peer pressure where people say, hey, I can't smoke cannabis, it makes me paranoid. Plenty of folks understand. And if you don't want to use it, there's really no pressure. And then there's more for other folks to enjoy if that's what they want.
Oh, very well put. Well, Dr. Mitch, we always appreciate you talking to us every other Monday here on the Marijuana Agenda. And for folks that want to learn much more and get more in depth on this, Dr. Mitch has his own podcast on Cannabis Radio entitled Burning Issues. And how's the podcast going? Do you have some new guests for us to learn about?
We're going to hear from the beloved Dr. Lester Grinspoon real soon, but we've also got some ADHD experts who've been chiming in on the potential and the potential downside of cannabis for treating at least subtypes of ADHD. I think your listeners would really get a kick out of it.
All right. Check that out at cannabisradio.com. It's the Burning Issues podcast with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. And Dr. Mitch, thanks for joining us again. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Take care.